It's Big Picture Week on Techonomics. Political and popular culture have been whipsaws for the past couple of years. Coming up, host Jason Middleton chats with an author about the macro view of the world that may lead us through this age of discovery. And that conversation starts now.
Hello, and thanks for listening. This week, we thought we'd try and slow things down a little, try to make some headspace for some bigger picture discussions. Over the past several years, it's been hard to find a calm center in this spinning universe. By that, I mean incessant so-called breaking news, a political wave of disruption like Brexit and the Trump election, technology and privacy and platform issues about who owns our data. Heck, even Earth is trying to pass something. I mean, have you seen those volcanoes in Hawaii recently? It's almost as if human society, writ large, is going through a spasm of innovation and feeling the blowback and disruption that it can cause.
There is a lot of anxiety. There is a lot of frustration. There's a lot of people feeling left behind. And you have some very capable populist figureheads right now who see it, are activating that, and it is a real threat to the status quo. So if you think that there is something positive operating in, you know, the European project of unification, or in globalization, or in global migration, or all these things that you take for granted, now is the moment where you need to stand up and make a very strong, powerful case for why they should continue.
Columbus, Copernicus, Gutenberg, and others redrew the maps of the world, liberated information, and shifted Western civilization from the medieval to the early modern era. Those progressions came at a price: social division, political extremism, economic shocks, and pandemics. Our next guest is an author who argues that we've been here before, the first renaissance, and that conversation starts now.
Chris Catarna, I'm an Oxford scholar and co-author of Age of Discovery, Navigating the Storms of Our Second Renaissance.
So, Chris, thank you for your time. I want to begin at the very, very beginning. Like, this is the paperback edition of Age of Discovery. But what was the impetus between you and your co-author, Ian Golden, to get into this book in the beginning?
Okay, so that is taking us way back because, yeah. I mean, like many books, this one has a long and tortured history. But really, it goes back as far as 2009, 2010, when, I mean, really it was in the aftermath of the global financial crisis, which, gosh, this year is the 10th anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are in this moment where the experts have been proven badly wrong. Right? I mean, international finance was supposed to be the one domain of this tangled global moment we live in that was the best understood, because, of course, they've got unlimited money to make sense of the time we're in, and just catastrophically missed so many warning signs that led to then the global financial crisis. And that, for us, was a signal to start asking some bigger questions around how do we look at the now? And the lens that we look at the present through, is it helping us to see the storms that are coming, or is it blinding us from them?
Mm-hmm.
And we felt that, well, I mean, taking the lesson from the financial crisis, it's probably the latter. And if it is the latter, well, then how on earth do we step back, right? Like, how do we find some perspective that helps us to step out of the way we are seeing and to see what we're missing? And we felt that, you know, when we live in a global moment, you know, these forces of globalization and technological disruption, there really is no place you can step to step away and see some perspective. And so the only thing that's kind of left to us is to step to a different time, right, and to try to see some depth in the present moment by looking at it from another place in time. And, you know, when that becomes your way to step out of the now, pretty quickly we identified the Renaissance, sort of this period, you know, marked by Gutenberg's press, by these voyages of discovery, by these new technologies to understand the world, by populism and bonfires of vanity and European institutions breaking in half, as a kind of metaphor to help us better set some expectations for the now. Fast forward to today, and boy, it does seem that it's been a pretty powerful lens for us.
Yeah, it definitely has. And there are so many places we could start, because if you just take it from the disruptive viewpoint, I read, reading in the introduction to the paperback edition that I have in front of me, is you guys, through your research, kind of predicted not just Brexit, but the rise of Donald Trump's populism and his election. How did you come across that?
It wasn't kind of. I mean, we got on stage in early 2016 and we said, okay, we're about to be unpopular because we're going to make two predictions here. You know, the first is this referendum that Britain has coming up on membership in the EU. The country's going to vote to leave. And the second is that, you know, this guy who you think could never possibly become president of the United States, our money is on that he will be elected. And let me tell you, it's one of those times where you really pay a price for being right.
Right.
You gain some credibility in your arguments and you lose a lot of friends along the way. So I don't know if we came out ahead, but and really, I mean, in all seriousness, the argument we were trying to make, and kind of just like I was suggesting earlier, is to say to people, look at the moment that we are in. You know, look at how we are tearing up everything that we thought we knew about the present, about society, and recasting it with everything from, you know, where is the global center of the economy? And it was the Atlantic, and now it's moving to the Pacific and to Eurasia, to things like artificial intelligence and genetic modification, and we have this social medium now. Do we really believe in a moment like this that we can get through it with such narrow expectations, right, with such linear expectations about the future and not be shocked? And, you know, again, this was sort of our, it was a very tired argument we were making by then, but how long has it been? I mean, how short-term is our memory? Remember this thing called the financial crisis and how shocking that was. And we're telling you, if you read the political tea leaves, there is a lot of anxiety. There is a lot of frustration. There's a lot of people feeling left behind. And you have some very capable populist figureheads right now who see it, are activating that, and it is a real threat to the status quo. So if you think that there is something positive operating in, you know, the European project of unification, or in globalization, or in global migration, or all these things that you take for granted, now is the moment where you need to stand up and make a very strong, powerful case for why they should continue, because there are now strongly made arguments with a lot of conviction on the other side. So that was the argument that we were making. I mean, and very simply, if you go back to, you know, the European Renaissance, you had similarly, a society that was just caught completely flat-footed by shock events. And, you know, so kind of for the historians in the room here, this year is the 500th anniversary of a religious and political revolution in Europe called the Protestant Reformation, which, of course, led by Martin Luther, this man who, you know, classically he nailed his arguments against the Catholic Church in Rome to a church door in Wittenberg. These comments are taken down, they're printed far and wide, they're translated across Europe, and they ignite a popular revolt against what was in Europe the ultimate symbol of establishment power, which was the Catholic Church.
Right.
And, you know, so 2 years ago, we're saying to people, and you think that something is, you know, some little thing like Brexit couldn't happen? You know, you believe that the European project of unity can only go in one direction? I mean, read your history books, people. You know, these projects are fragile things. Democracy is a fragile thing. In every generation, there comes a moment where we need to stand up and revitalize and refresh our commitment to some of the core values that hold our society together. And our bet is that this is the year.
Right.
May we live in interesting times.
Your book kind of tips towards an optimism that we will get to in just a moment, because in your answer there, you mentioned democracy and the survival of democracy. Of course, the original Renaissance did not occur with liberal Western democracies like we are used to now in the 19th and 20th centuries. How did that system deal or not deal with these shocks to the system, as you reference in your answer and in your book, the shock of it?
So that's a really good point that, you know, there are some important differences between the Western world of 500 years ago and the world we live in now. And democracy is this big new, you know, political technology that we've installed across Western civilization. And it does a very good job of creating pressure relief valves in society. You know, when things go badly wrong, we can vote for change. You know, one of the, I guess, great achievements of the last 10 years is that the financial crisis, which had, you know, catastrophic consequences really across the developed world, it didn't result in, you know, that much violence or unrest in our society. It resulted in an awful lot of political change, right? But for the most part, that change was peaceful. 500 years ago in Europe, events like the Protestant Reformation or the bonfire of vanity, which is an enormously fascinating analogy to Donald Trump today, but essentially this populist outsider, this false prophet who walks into Florence with this rhetoric that he's going to make Florence great again and kicks the Medici out of power, who were the elite establishment of the time. These events 500 years ago, they sparked a century of religious war. Between the sort of the 1520s and the 1620s, Europe saw, you know, maybe a handful of years where there was peace in a century, and saw the biggest sort of refugee crisis that the continent had ever seen since the fall of the Roman Empire and would ever see again until World War I. So, you know, democracy is this big difference. But it also means that, and again, I think that we are so alive to this now, there is so much social pressure that is building up as a consequence of the economic, technological, social change that we are living through. And our democratic processes are basically the only big relief valve that we have for those pressures. So don't be surprised if a lot gets channeled through them. I mean, we talk a lot today about how politicized, how divided politically our societies have become. But of course they have, because that is our relief valve. And so, you know, you're right that I do have a bit of an optimistic hat, I guess. It's hard to, it just fits my head so well that I never take it off. But so I do see in these shock events like a vote for Brexit or in the election of a President Trump, fundamentally I do see a positive indicator of just how resilient our politics is to what is, in historic terms, just an extraordinarily challenging moment for society to go through.
I loved a part of that answer. Well, I loved the whole answer, of course, but a phrase.
And I'm going to throw away the rest.
Right, exactly. I'm going to edit this part. No, the use of political technology being democracy, that's a marvelous phrase, and I'm going to borrow it from my next dinner party. I want to kind of go back to, okay, this is kind of a tech show, and we're going to get back into societal questions in just a moment, including your optimism. But let's talk about distribution, because Martin Luther published through the Gutenberg Press his pushback against the Catholic Church. The internet. I follow a couple of marketplace analysts who refer to the internet as the central nervous system of the 21st century. Is this present renaissance that we are probably going through and the shocks that we are definitely dealing with, are those fomented? Are they curbed? Are they aided in any way by the internet?
I think there's no question that they are. And again, you know, if I think through a historical lens, I mean, you could not understand the transformation that Western civilization went through sort of from the 15th to the 16th century without understanding the advent of the printing press, Gutenberg's printing press. And, you know, maybe just briefly to make the comparison, I mean, imagine what it must have been like, you know, to live in the 1450s in a world where every single piece of information that you possessed had to have been physically written by an other person. And it creates this environment of information scarcity. And then in your own lifetime, that limitation just vanishes from society. I mean, you had parents who had never seen a book have children for whom books were just an ordinary part of their lived daily lives. What's remarkable is that, frankly, I mean, there are very few humans, very few societies that have ever lived on this planet that could relate to that. We are one of them, right? We know exactly what that's like, right? I mean, I was born in the late 70s, not to date myself, but, you know, so I'm one of those people who straddled the analog and the digital world, who used to go to Blockbuster and now watches Netflix.
Right.
So we know what it is to live through the advent of a new medium, and we know how politically disruptive it is to go from a world where, you know, kind of only the priests and the princes had an audience to one where, you know, suddenly everyone has a pulpit, and how it changes our just intuitions about what is truth and what is falsehood. So I don't think that when the history of our own time is written, you know, people will be able to make sense of it, you know, especially the politics, without recognizing that one thing that happened here at the dawn of the 21st century is that the whole medium that civilization uses to communicate shifted from the analog to the digital, and really shifted from the print medium to this new digital medium. What's interesting about this shift is, even though, you know, digital is a progressive technological step beyond print, in a way, culturally, we've actually taken a step backward to the way things were in the oral medium. You know, what was true? What was true was whatever got said to the biggest audience.
Right.
That's why the church, that's why the princes, they controlled reality, right? They said what was and what wasn't, because they were the only ones who said anything that reached into the minds of many people. You know, everyone else just had their individual scraps of information. And we live in that world now, again, where, you know, it seems that what is true is what gets said to the most people. If the audience to the lie is bigger than the audience to the fact check, it's the lie that is the broader social shared truth. And in the oral culture, one thing that people had was they understood the power to ignore. They understood that, you know, because speech equals truth, we really have to ask hard questions about what speech will we listen to, and, you know, and who is just the crazy who's standing on a box.
Right.
Today, I think we struggle with that. I mean, for me, Donald Trump is maybe the, you know, whatever your political leanings, I think is maybe the clearest demonstration of that. I mean, we think, and this is very sort of print culture thinking, that, you know, because he is an authority, because he is powerful, we must listen to him. But actually, the direction of causation is exactly the opposite. It's because we had to listen to him that he became powerful. And we haven't yet relearned this critical skill of an oral culture, which is simply the power to ignore people.
Right.
I think.
Wow. Yeah. In that answer, too, I was going to ask you about what the present day proxy for 15th century religion would be. But I think we should stay on the prophet and bonfires thing, because you touched on Donald Trump there. Can we go back and think about the Renaissance and, like you said, the Bonfire of the Vanities and the Medicis? Since it's a good part of part three of the book, I thought we might be able to dwell on this one a little bit and drill into it. What can we extrapolate from what you're finding in research around the prophets and bonfires then as to what now? Because I'm trying to find a link between what your research shows and your book, The Age of Discovery. We're speaking with Chris Kutarna, by the way. He's an Oxford scholar, co-author of Age of Discovery, Navigating the Storm of Our Second Renaissance. You remain optimistic. I am less optimistic. Can you convince me?
Well, maybe, and I don't want to make too many assumptions about where the sources of your pessimism might lie. I mean, let's take the presidency of Donald Trump, for example. It's fashionable in liberal circles to sort of wonder if Mueller will succeed in, you know, digging up the dirt that will impeach Trump ultimately or something like that. You know, with my silver lining, so here's my optimistic argument. I mean, I would say, no, don't impeach Trump. He's too useful a teacher. What has the presidency of Donald Trump done? I think it's raising the awareness for everyone, and not just in the United States, which I really see as the center of our second renaissance, but really around the world, about the fragility of the moment we are in. And, you know, the key questions that we all need to answer, and by all of us, I mean sort of the advanced liberal democracies in the world, are the questions that Donald Trump is posing. It's like, you know, how do we maintain that kind of respectful public discourse upon which democracy depends without it being drowned out into some kind of unaccountable lawlessness? How do we maintain the sovereignty of our own citizens in this globally open media age where foreign interference is so easy to do and hard to detect? You know, how do we pass on to the next generation the value of democratic freedoms? Democracy is sort of on the decline around the world. If we're taking these things for granted, you know, how do we improve inclusion for those left behind by rapid change while still remaining open to the positive forces of change? These are the questions that ultimately, you know, our capacity to answer them is going to determine whether, out of the stresses of this moment, you know, do we sort of somehow reach a new level, some higher plane of social organization, of political maturity, or do they tear us apart? We do need to confront these questions. They are urgent. And the fact that we are so obsessed with them right now, I actually think is a tremendously good thing. And 2 years ago, these weren't on the top of our agenda at all. So we can't avoid the difficult questions. Right. I think that this is always the lesson of history, is that the crises that we struggle with as a civilization, in hindsight, they are the compass that points the way. Right? What we need to worry about, what we need to do, how we navigate through this storm isn't a mystery, because it is all around us. We are in the storm. And I think so long as we have a positive narrative to hold on to the belief of progress, the belief that, you know, out of our age of discovery, that we can, you know, similarly realize a new and better age, right? As long as we have some kind of positive narrative to bind it together, then I think that we can get through these storms. So that's my positive argument.
Well, you've actually assuaged my pessimism a bit, actually. Thank you for that. I was intrigued by part four, which is magnify flourishing genius and mitigate flourishing risk. Can you tease out the summary there of that last section of the book?
What we, you know, all struggle with sort of from our individual lives, our business, society, you know, policymakers, is how do we lead well through a moment where it seems that everything is happening. Actually, you know, through a Renaissance lens, it's pretty clear about what we need to do. And it is precisely those two things, to magnify the flourishing of genius and to mitigate the risks. And so, you know, wherever we stand in this moment, I think that if we look for the opportunity to do those two things, then we are making our positive contribution to the moment. So to take one, for example, around magnifying flourishing genius. In the corporate environment, it used to be that, you know, diversity was a good thing. In a Renaissance moment, I think that diversity is a critical imperative. It's a key source of competitive advantage. It's how we create communities that surprise our own thinking into the new directions that we need to head in order to keep ahead of rapid change. Yeah, magnifying genius and mitigating risks, I think, is about looking for the opportunities to do both those things within our families, within our organizations, and ultimately within our larger communities.
It sounds like, and I could be oversimplifying this, and if I am, please do correct me. It sounds like we will basically be picking winners and losers as we go through this shocking time, this unsettling and somewhat stressful time. Of course, they did it 500 years ago as well. There were winners and losers that came out of it. I referenced Copernicus, Gutenberg, and others. But if we are ignorant to the history, how are we best prepared? I mean, obviously, you have to read the book, Age of Discovery, I think, to get that context. But again, why should I be optimistic that we will somehow find our way to pick a winner and loser? Like, I have to go back to democracy. I mean, granted, I've all lived my entire life under a democracy, so it's hard for me to imagine anything else. You, as a historian, can imagine other thing else and do very well. But again, are we relying on market effects here? Are we relying about people actually doing the research and reading the books and turning the pages and figuring out some kind of historical context to help us deal and cope and move things forward? Because I'm still kind of stuck on idle right now. I don't usually use blurbs, but, you know, Sir Richard Branson right here on the cover, A Powerful Journey, this book will help the world. Well, I can't make everybody read it, but I mean, I want to help the world. And you do too.
And so hopefully by the end of the last page of the book, and if you don't have time to read the book, then by the end of our conversation here, what the message I actually want people to get is that it's not about optimism, right? I mean, in some ways, the first Renaissance ended in tragedy. We had a century of religious war. We had the voyages of discovery, which were great for some people and, you know, decimated indigenous populations in you know, our native North America. It's not a Pollyannic story that says, oh, you know, we are heading into a new golden age. Just sit back and enjoy the ride. I think that the lesson from history is just the opposite, which is to say that the present is a contest that will determine the course of the next 500 years. You know, pessimism is not the right mode for now, you know, because to be pessimistic, I think, is to ignore the tremendous power that we have to shape and to reshape the direction that civilization goes. Optimism, I don't think, is the right mode for now either, because it so easily slips into kind of a, you know, just a fatalism. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's all going to happen somehow. I think that the right mode for now is an activism that recognizes. So you say, you know, is it just down to markets? Markets have a role to play. Mm-hmm. Business has a role to play. The public sector and government also has an incredibly important role to play, right, in setting the rules. You know, what are the laws going to be that help to shape the consequences of artificial intelligence, that help to shape the consequences of globalization, of the automation of work, of, you know, the transformation from an industrial era where we had capital and we had labor and we had unions to sort of a knowledge era where, you know, half of the workforce is in a gig economy that doesn't have full-time contracts. And we can make that work. We are creating tremendous wealth in society, but we also have to make some choices about the winners and losers. If we look back at maybe the last 25 years of development since, you know, the fall of the Berlin Wall, since the advent of the internet, since China re-entered global markets, we have kind of, at an elite policy level, had this perspective that the market is going to drive this moment. Mm-hmm. And we can rely upon market outcomes to lift all boats. I think that today, you know, when our agenda is as full with the vulnerabilities and the unintended consequences of everything that we've been doing for the past 25 years, as it is with the possibilities, that this is the moment where we have to have just a much more mature outlook. You know, politically, in the business world, individually as citizens, that we need to shape outcomes. We need to shape the distribution of gains and losses. We need to shape the access to the possibilities in this moment. And, you know, the world is not flat. That was the naivety of the 90s. Mm. The world is mountainous. And let's look at all of the practical frictions, the immobilities that make it hard for a lot of segments of society to move as fluidly through the opportunities of this moment as the economists wish we could. And then what can we do as a society with all of these new resources we've created to deal with those frictions? Those are the kind of questions that we need to be asking as a society. And once we start asking them, we very quickly see that there is a role for every sector of society to play. And if that's the kind of attitude that we have on it, then I believe that we can make out of this second renaissance the dawn of a new enlightenment.
I appreciate all of your time this morning. I appreciate this book. I can't wait to finish it. I'm glad I skipped to the end because now I'm excited to finish it.
Jason, thank you for those generous words.
That was Chris Kutarna. He's co-author of Age of Discovery, Navigating the Risks and Rewards of Our New Renaissance. The new updated paperback is out now. This is part two of this interview for broadcast. On the podcast, though, we have an extended version of this discussion with Chris. To find that link and all of our links, go to KGORadio.com for this week's show notes. We also live at Facebook.com/Techonomics Radio. We have links to the music we use there as well. Coming up after the break, the second half of Big Picture Week on Techonomics, we're looking at doing capitalism in the innovation economy.
Here's the irony, the central irony of where we are. The digital revolution was sponsored in every particular, in every one of its components, by the mission-driven American state.
That's next, so please stick around. I'm Jason Middleton, and this is Techonomics.